Entering the land of Canaan, of course, has to do with a bit of Israel's history, and it's recorded for us in the book of Joshua. As we sort of tune in on this little episode of their history, we get the feeling that there was a lot of excitement going on in the camp of Israel. Anticipation was running very high because something very eventful was about to happen to them. They believed that a promise that was made by God to them 470 years previously was about to be fulfilled, because God had told Abraham that to him and his posterity would he give the land of Canaan. And here they were, right at the borders of the land of Canaan when this story begins. Perhaps there were some at that time that were still skeptical. They were perhaps remembering back 40 years previously, when only after 3 months after having left the land of Egypt, they stood at that time right at the borders of the land of Canaan, awaiting the report of those that had been sent into the land to spy it out and to give them some idea of what the land was like and how they should go about taking it. And when these spies came back and reported, many, many of the people at that time, their anticipation turned to fear, and they wanted to go back down into the land of Egypt. Paul tells us that that generation of Israel lacked the kind of faith that they needed. 40 terrible years in the wilderness of Sinai Desert had taken the toll of that entire generation. Even Moses was now dead. He had only glimpsed this land from afar, from a mountaintop. And only two of that entire generation, of those over 20 that came out of the land of Egypt, were now still living. Only two who knew that 40 years ago that they could have gone into that land and that they could have taken it, that God would have given it to them then, if they just had the faith and trust that they should have had. Two that knew that that land was indeed a land that flowed with milk and honey, that it was a rich land. The land of Canaan back there apparently was not the dry, arid, rather poor land that we know today, except as it's been cultivated and made to produce through irrigation. But apparently, according to historians, it was a very well-watered land at that time, and a very fertile one. I'll just read you one short excerpt from Grecke's history. He says, "The records of Ramses II of Egypt show the conditions of Palestine and adjacent countries in the age of Moses prior to the Exodus. The Egyptian king brought back from there gold, glass, gum, cattle, ivory, ebony, boats, horses, chariots inwrought with gold and silver, iron, steel, dates, oil, wine, asses, cedar, suits of armor, war galleys, incense, gold dishes, precious stones, honey, lead, brass, paints, all plunder of a rich and civilized land. The meadows of Palestine, its fortresses, its groves, and its orchards are mentioned, showing that prosperity of every kind abounded." It's just a little glimpse of what that land was like, apparently. And the two faithful spies, they weren't overawed by the fortresses and by the armed might that they saw in that land, which this historian mentions, but they knew that with God's help that they could go in and take this land and make it theirs. And now they were, 40 years later, again at the very borders of the land of Canaan, all new faces except Caleb and Joshua. Joshua was 83 years old, but he was still very strong and agile. After Moses' death, while he was the logical leader for the children of Israel, he had been Moses' right-hand man for many years, and he apparently possessed great leadership ability in his own right. It was he who led Israel in their first battle against the Amalekites and won that battle with the Lord's help. And after Moses' death, why, he was the one that the people seemed to have their confidence in as a leader. But more than this, the Lord especially authorized Joshua to be a leader, especially authorized him to take command. And Joshua, we find, like Moses, was was a very meek man. And instead of attempting to grasp authority, as he probably well could have in his position, he didn't really accept authority until the Lord encouraged him to take leadership responsibility. "There shall not any man be able to stand before thee all the days of thy life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. I will not fail thee nor forsake thee. Be strong and of good courage. Be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for the Lord thy God is with thee whithersoever thou goest." These are the Lord's words to Joshua. And Joshua no sooner had received this kind of authority to lead the children of Israel than he issued a very rather startling command. At least it must have been startling to the Israelites back then, to the officers of the army and so on. He says, "Pass through the hosts and command the people, saying, prepare your victuals, for within 3 days you shall pass over this Jordan to go in to possess the land which the Lord giveth you to possess." Ah, now how did the people receive this news? Times had changed and people had changed. This generation had not long since fought the armies of the Midianites. That was a strong army, and they had destroyed them under the leadership of Joshua. Of course, with the Lord's help. They were far more confident than their ancestors, and besides, I imagine by this time they were tired of this wandering through the wilderness of Sinai Desert, and they were ready to go in and take this land and to conquer it. Listen to their reply to Joshua. "All that thou commandest we will do, and whithersoever thou sendest we will go." And the Lord outlines to Joshua just what would be the boundaries of the land. He said, "From this wilderness, the southern boundary, northward to Lebanon, eastward to the Euphrates River, westward to the Mediterranean Sea." And if you locate these on the map, you'll find that it's a pretty broad expanse of land, which Israel only occupied a very small portion of, and today just a fragment of, really. Joshua immediately begins preparation for this. He sends 2 spies into the land, not 40. He picked 2 good men and sent them into the land to spy it out. And the Lord sent them into the city of Jericho, into Rahab's house. And that's a story in itself. But Rahab, as you'll recall, was one that the Apostle Paul commends for having faith when she received these spies, having faith to save their lives when the king of Jericho sought to take them as spies. She saved them because she said that by the things that she had seen and the way the Lord had blessed Israel and worked with Israel and made them conquer over their enemies, that indeed the Lord was a strong Lord, and he was one that was going to give them the land. And all that she asked was that when they took the city of Jericho, which she was certain that they would, is that they save her and her family alive. And they made preparation to do that. She helped them escape. And when they returned, they reported to Joshua pretty much what Rahab had told them about the land, and especially about Jericho, because they tell us, the report says, that they hid in the mountains for 3 days. And I doubt if they saw very much in the mountain, but the report that they gave to Joshua was almost word for word what Rahab told them, that the people of the land were terribly frightened of them and that they could overcome them militarily. And so Joshua selected as the day that they were to enter Canaan the 10th day of the first month, the month of Nisan, exactly to the day 40 years from the time they left Egypt. And from this standpoint, it was really a very unfavorable time of the year, because the Jordan River, which they had to cross, they had no bridges, they had no boats, they had to cross it, their armies and all of these people, was at flood stage. And normally it was about 100 feet across at the point that they crossed, I understand, but at this time of the year it was many times that. But this fact didn't seem to deter the enthusiasm of the people. And when they made camp that night on the bank of the river, Joshua encouraged them by saying that on tomorrow the Lord is going to do great things among you, great wonders. And Joshua said, "Hereby shall ye know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Hivites and all these tribes that lived in the land of Canaan." These were all established kingdoms which they had to conquer in order to possess the land. And in the third and fourth chapter of Joshua, we have an account of the history of their wars with these people. Joshua's directions were that the people should watch the ark. They should keep their eye on the ark, that it would precede them, according to his directions, about three-quarters of a mile in front of the people. It was to be carried by the priests, all the people were to follow this to a point at the river where they were to cross. And as the priests began to get closer and closer to the river with this ark, carrying this ark, you can imagine it must have been quite a moment of suspense. As people watch, you can sort of put yourself in their place and wonder just what was going to happen, because the Lord didn't say what he was going to do. He didn't say how he was going to handle this problem of getting across this river with them. Perhaps some of them remembered how they got across the Red Sea and hoped maybe that this would be the solution. As the priests began to walk up to the water's edge, as the first priest reached the water, why, sure enough, it began to recede. As the soles of his feet touched the water, why, to the astonishment of all, why, the water just began to shrink back. And as they walked on into the riverbed, the water just kept shrinking back and receding until finally they were standing in the middle of the riverbed, and it was completely dry. That is, there was no water in it. And then on directions of Joshua, all of the people quickly crossed over to the opposite bank. The account says that the waters which came down from above stood and rose up upon a heap very far from the city of Adam, and those that came down towards the Sea of the Plain, even the Salt Sea, failed and were cut off, and the people passed over right against Jericho. Historians believe that there was perhaps an earthquake that caused a blockage of the river for a time long enough for them to get across. And then Joshua commanded a rather strange thing to be done. 12 men that he had chosen, one for each tribe of Israel, to take a stone from the riverbed and to carry it over with them to dry ground, and they made a monument out of these stones. And Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priests which bear the Ark of the Covenant stood. And the scripture adds that they are there unto this day. I'm not sure whether they're still there or not. And these 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan did Joshua pitch in Gilgal. And he spake unto the children of Israel, saying, "When your children shall ask your fathers in time to come, what meanest these stones? Then ye shall let your children know, saying, Israel came over this Jordan on dry land, that all the people of the earth might know the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty." And then the priests were ordered to come up out of the river, and its waters returned and overflowed its banks. Now this was quite a blow, of course, to all the Canaanite tribes, because they felt that as long as this river was at flood stage, there was a measure of safety. But now their enemies were crossed. And the account says that when they heard what happened, their hearts melted, neither was their spirit in them anymore. The first thing that the Lord commanded was the circumcision of all of the men of Israel. And 4 days later, they kept the Passover on the plains of Jericho. And they did eat the old corn of the land on the morrow after the Passover, unleavened cakes, parched corn, in the selfsame day. And the manna ceased on the morrow after they had eaten the old corn of the land. Neither had the children of Israel manna any more, but they did eat the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. Is there a picture in all of this? Well, I can't say for certain. I don't feel that everything in the Bible has an illustrative meaning. There are certainly many valuable lessons to us to be found here, how faith was rewarded in the case of Rahab, how the Lord helped Israel when they believed in him and helped them to overcome such great obstacles as they did in entering the land. Paul, in the third chapter and the fourth chapters of Hebrews, draws a lesson from the fact that the unfaithful Israelites, which originally left Egypt, were not permitted to enter the land. Only he puts it in a different way. He says they were not permitted to enter into his rest. Who were they that heard and were yet rebellious? Was it not all those who left Egypt under the leadership of Moses, and with whom he was provoked 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned and whose bodies fell in the wilderness, and to whom he did swear that they should never enter into his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see they were not able to enter in because of unbelief. Paul here seems to be using this experience of Israel then in a pictorial way. He goes on to explain that God's rest began on the seventh day of creation, a day which was to see the completion of God's purpose for the earth and for mankind. Man in his original perfection and his original dominion was commissioned to complete this work and complete this purpose for the earth. But after the fall, man lost his dominion. He was not able to subdue the earth. He was not able to take possession of it. He was not able to fill it with a race that possessed life. And the terrible wilderness experience of man began. Joshua's name originally was Joshua. It was changed to Joshua, which is the same as the name Jesus. And it means salvation. It means help. Can we see a picture here? Well, let's take a look. Consider the nation of Israel as representing the world of mankind, having been led up to a position, as it were, where they can almost look over and see this land of rest. And you know, the world almost feels that way today. They certainly on the other side of the river because there's no rest, but they can almost look over and see it. At least they think they do. Waiting in travail and groaning for so long, so near and yet so far, the Jordan River is between. Impossible to cross without God's help. What does the river represent? It represents divine condemnation. It represents the curse. It represents the sentence of death. Mankind can never enter that land of rest until this is passed over. The very name Jordan means judge down, and remember how that it flowed into the Dead Sea. Look at it from this point of view. You see how appropriate it was that the Ark of God, representing God's covenant to mankind to relieve them of this curse of death, should stand in the midst of this river, representing the sentence of death, and it dried up the waters, effecting a cancellation of this sentence in order that the blessings promised, the rest promised, can be reached. And it was significant also that the ark was carried by the priests and the under-priests, and that these first passed into the Jordan before any of the people could cross over. And their standing in the midst of the river illustrates how the making free of this condemnation will be by the hands of the great high priest and his associate priests. Jesus gave himself for the world's sins. He became a curse for us. He stopped in the midst of the Jordan that the world might have the opportunity of passing over. The under priests, his followers, also stopped there too. They lay down their lives in the world and to aid in the world's opportunity to completely pass out from under the terrible curse of death that is upon them and has afflicted their minds and hearts. It was not necessary that, in this instance, that the priests should remain in the Jordan, in the river, and die there in order to complete the picture. 12 stones were taken from each of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel, 1 stone for each tribe. And they were placed exactly where the priests stood, representing the 144,000 out of all of the tribes of Israel who constitute the royal priesthood. Paul tells us how that how the Gentiles are represented also in this 144,000 out of each of the 12 tribes, who became dead with Christ according to the flesh. They didn't cross over. They gave up their earthly inheritance for the divine nature to help in the blessing of all the families of the earth, to help in the lifting of the curse. The first commandment the Lord gave when they crossed over and entered Canaan was to circumcise the people. And when this was done, the Lord said to Joshua, "This day have I rolled away the reproach of Egypt from off you." The reproach of Egypt was enslavement. It was their separation from the land of Canaan. And this followed them all through their wilderness experience. They were a people without a land. And now they were home. Now they were free. Now the dangers were past. Or were they? Joshua went out in the evening and stood on the plains, looking up at the great high walls of this city of Jericho, a mighty fortress which blocked their way yet into the land. The world of mankind in the resurrection, having been delivered out from under the legal sentence, out from under this kind of bondage and reproach of the land of the great adversary, as he refers to here, the reproach of the land of Egypt, and they're having their feet planted in the land, actually standing there in the land of promise, will also have a great barrier like Jericho before them, a great citadel of sin which must be overcome, the imperfection of mankind that remains. As Joshua looked around that wall, he no doubt was trying to find where there might be some weakness in it that he could use as a means of acquiring access to the city or destroying it, the wall, by which he could get his armies into Jericho to overcome them. And as he was standing there, a man approached him with a drawn sword. And it came to pass that when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted up his eyes and looked and beheld, and there stood a man over against him with a sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went unto him and said unto him, "Art thou for us or for our adversaries?" And he said, "Nay, but as captain of the hosts of the Lord, I am now come." He was talking to an angel. He didn't realize it until the angel spoke. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and did worship and said unto him, "What sayest my Lord unto his servant?" And the captain of the Lord's host said unto Joshua, "Loose thy shoes from off thy foot, for the place wherein thou standest is holy." The first requirement of the kingdom will be reverence for God, reverence and honor for those who speak for him. The angel told Joshua that the Lord was going to help him to overcome this city, but by a very unorthodox method, not by a military method at all, a method that would no doubt try the faith of every Israelite in the camp of Israel. And instead of using their armies to try to destroy this wall and try to destroy the city, what the angel told them to do was to use the ark that they were to march around the city of Jericho one time for 6 days, one time each day for 6 days, with seven priests in front of it blowing trumpets of ram's horns, the armies in front of them, and all the people behind the ark. And this they did. Can you imagine how incredulous this plan might have seemed to some of those Israelites? How they might have doubted that this kind of action would be successful at all. But these Israelites, for these Israelites, the Lord had just performed some wonderful miracles. He just dried up the Jordan River, and they were ready to listen to God and to follow his instructions. Paul says it was by faith that the walls of Jericho fell down. The faith of those Israelites at that time who carried out God's instructions. Imagine how ready the world will be to follow the methods of God in the kingdom after experiencing such wonderful miracles as the resurrection of the dead. No matter how contrary the ways of God might seem to be from the ways of man, whether it seemeth foolish or not, at this time the people entered into this plan wholeheartedly. And what a beautiful picture of the way sin will be destroyed in the kingdom. The people will recognize and follow the presence of God as represented in the ark, in the Christ, the Ark of the Covenant, the law administration of the people. The trumpet of truth will be heralded forth by the priesthood of that age, and the people, in their desire to fully enter into the land, will shout for joy. And the high fortress wall of sin and evil will just crumble away, having been raised upward for nearly over 6,000 years by the adversary. And in a very short time, the Lord will just cause it to crumble away. The cooperation of mankind will make that kingdom a success. Nothing of Jericho was to be left or was to be destroyed. When they blew the trumpet on the seventh day and all the people shouted, the walls just fell down flat, it says. And the armies moved in, and they were instructed to destroy everything in the city of Jericho except those things that the Lord had told them should be dedicated to him and the family of Rahab because of her faith. No vestige of sin will remain when the kingdom is ended. The people of the earth will be required to destroy every stain of it in themselves or be destroyed. And the city of Jericho was never to be built again, as they tell us here, we're told in the book of Joshua. And so, friends, we must prepare ourselves now to march as future trumpeters, as the priests were ordered to do in this unique battle against sin, when the Lord, our Joshua, will fight his battle of Jericho and the walls will come tumbling down.
Thank you, Brother George. I'll ask Brother George to close this portion of the meeting and also to ask the blessing on the next service to follow.
Our dear Heavenly Father, we thank thee for thy word, for all the lessons that thou hast prepared for us in thy word. And now as we further wait before thee, we ask thy blessing upon our Brother Ted as he ministers to us. Help us to be strengthened in our service to thee. We ask in Jesus' name.